I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. After months of trying out recipes, baking bread with those sourdough starters, and trying to breathe new life into old favorites, are you ready to put dinner back in the hands of the experts? With vaccination rates slowly rising and COVID infection rates quickly falling, restaurateurs are hoping that people will once again embrace the joys of dining out after months of pandemic hibernation. Today on Midday, a status report on restaurants. Marshall Weston of the Restaurant Association of Maryland, Emily Lerman of the Mira Kitchen Collective, and Christina Tassick of the Baltimore Sun join me to talk about how eateries have pivoted to adjust to the new normal and the prospects for the summer season. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. As we enter this Memorial Day weekend, folks are feeling much, much better about going out and enjoying the things that we weren't able to enjoy during the long months of the pandemic. For people who are vaccinated, going to a restaurant is no longer tantamount to risking your life. For unvaccinated people, it's a different story for them and for those around them. But as more people, including teens and children, get their jabs, that special date or taking the family out are no longer a problem. Today on Midday, three perspectives on restaurants from the president of the Maryland Restaurant Association, a restaurateur who is working on changing the model for how restaurants operate, and a reporter who covers the restaurant scene here in Baltimore. A little later in the show, I'll speak with Emily Lerman, co-founder of the Mira Kitchen Collective, who also works with the Baltimore Roundtable for Economic Democracy, and Christina Tassick of the Baltimore Sun. But first, Marshall Weston joins me. He is the president and CEO of the Restaurant Association of Maryland, an organization that represents about 25% of the restaurants in our state. Marshall Weston joins us on Zoom. Our conversation was taped earlier this week, so we can't take any calls or online comments. Marshall, welcome to the show.
Hello, and thanks for having me on.
So at the beginning of the pandemic, there were a number of, frankly, dire predictions about how restaurants would fare, given the fact that at that time we were in a lockdown. Tell us what you all thought might happen with your membership back when we started and where things actually are now.
Well, we were very concerned, not only because of the lockdowns and the restrictions that restaurants had to deal with, but also concerned with consumer confidence and would diners feel comfortable going out to eat again and dining indoors. There were just so many things a year ago that we did not understand or have a handle on with this virus. And because of the unknown and the actions that we saw many restaurants taking and the restrictions that were being placed on our industry, we had made the prediction that up to 40% of all the restaurants in the state of Maryland could close permanently. And during those first couple months of the pandemic, we saw plenty of that. Many restaurants just did not have the savings to make it through the many weeks that turned into months, and closure rates were very high at the beginning of the pandemic. As time wore on and the pandemic dragged on, governments stepped in, whether it be federal, state, local governments, they set up funds and loan programs for restaurants. And because of those programs, we were able to get that number down. And today we're probably at fewer than 20% of all the restaurants closed, which is a big improvement, although sad to see so many restaurants gone.
Yeah, it's still a lot of restaurants and a lot of folks out of work, but certainly better than at one point had been expected and predicted. What are your members telling you about their take on people's willingness to start going out to eat again? Are they expecting, a good summer season now as we get into Memorial Day?
They absolutely are. And it's very ironic that, as I mentioned, a year ago, we were concerned about consumers wanting to be in restaurants at all ever again, or at a very limited number. But with the, what I'd like to say is a very good job we've done here in Maryland with vaccinations and the way we've handled this virus recently, I would say that consumers feel very confident and almost as much as just turning on a light switch and they're ready to go. Unfortunately, the industry isn't quite ramped up to meet the demand that the consumers are throwing at us right now, but the outlook does look very good and consumers do want to come back to restaurants in full force.
And I guess one of the issues that your members are dealing with is not just whether or not consumers will want to come back, but whether some or all of their employees are going to want to come back. Where do things stand in that regard? We hear that there are restaurants who are having a difficult time attracting enough workers, both front of house and back of house, to meet the demand. What are your folks telling you about that?
Well, this is not just a Maryland problem, and this is not just a restaurant problem. Across the country, our industry, along with many others, are experiencing workforce issues. We just don't have the employees to keep up with the work that needs to be done. So, we think that there's a lot of different reasons why employees have not returned to work in our industry full force as of yet, and certainly the federal unemployment boost and the stimulus checks play a part in that. But we're also finding that the availability of childcare is just not what it used to be. And we also still have families that have children at home and have not returned to in-person schooling. So that certainly plays an issue with this. And certainly we have people that are still COVID hesitant and not vaccinated and concerned. But another big part, specifically with restaurants, is we are an industry that deals with a lot of part-time employees. And many of those part-time employees have full-time jobs doing something else. And for part-time restaurant work, they take that money to save for vacations, to do home improvements, to pay for private school or college or whatever else they may have going on. And those people haven't really come back just as of yet. So we're hoping as time moves on and the summer progresses, we're going to see a lot more people returning to restaurants.
Is the summer a better time to be attracting a workforce than the spring or the winter? I mean, I think, for example, of educators. There are teachers who are not in school teaching during the summer, many of whom work in the restaurant industry while they're off from teaching. I mean, is there a bigger pool of folks given young people and, as you mentioned, these part-time folks and people who have jobs like teaching that allow them to have some time in the summer months?
Yes, absolutely. Whether it be young people who are in school that suddenly have more free time. And as you mentioned, many people are very surprised to learn how many teachers wait tables or bartend over the summer months to make more money, and they do very well. Teachers do a very good job in dealing with young students, and they have personality, and they just take those skills and they transfer very well into a restaurant server and bartender setting. So, as the summer does wear on and those school schedules loosen up, I think that we will see those people return.
I'm Tom Hall. It's midday here on this first day of Memorial Day weekend, the sort of unofficial start of summer. We're talking about restaurants. My guest is Marshall Weston. He's the president and CEO of the Restaurant Association of Maryland. We are recording our conversation, or I should say we have recorded our conversation, so we're not taking any calls or comments today. So, Marshall, we hear from people in the political sphere that unemployment and the subsidies that the federal government has offered is also a contributing factor to people not coming back to work. The narrative in some quarters is that they're actually making more money being unemployed than they would being employed. Are you hearing that narrative from your folks, your membership?
Not so much from my membership, but we do hear from states around the country that have offered up different incentives to get people to return to work. I know that one state, and I apologize, it escapes me right now, is offering a bonus for employees who return to work and then stay for up to 3 months or something along those lines. Again, you'll have to forgive me, I don't remember the specifics, but it's driving to the incentivizing people to get back into the industry where they were working, and certainly some people have moved around and have decided that maybe, you know, landscaping, for example, maybe isn't for them any longer, and they want to go to restaurants or they want to go to retail. So I think that it's going to take time for all of those things to kind of shake out. It's certainly frustrating to all business owners when you can see a demand that is there and you don't have the tools or the employees to make that happen. So I think there's certainly frustration, but a lot of the different things that we talked about earlier are contributing to this issue right now. I don't think it's just the federal unemployment boost.
Particularly in the shore communities, a lot of those communities, not just in the restaurant business, but in the food processing business, rely on workers from outside of the state, sometimes from outside of the country. And getting visas for some of those workers is often a problem. We hear about shortages of kids from Eastern Europe and Great Britain who often come to the shore communities, you know, Ocean City and places like that. What are you hearing from your membership about the availability of that kind of workforce this summer, given the COVID travel restrictions that are still in place in so many places?
Well, for many years now, we have been advocating for policies that increase those numbers of visas to get more people that are able to come specifically to Ocean City and the Eastern Shore during the summer months, because the demand far out, it just overwhelms the town of Ocean City, and the more employees they can get, the better. And it has been a struggle for many years, and COVID has certainly put a damper on the number of people that are going to be able to return this year. So we are talking a lot about how there is going to be a need for consumers to just be patient and understand that although they are ready to go and they expect things to return back to normal, it's going to take time for restaurants to ramp back up to, you know, those normal staffing levels. And unfortunately, we're not going to be getting as many people from overseas as we sometimes do.
There are a series of wage strikes that I understand are being planned around the country, not any here in Maryland, but towns like Chicago, New York, Washington, San Francisco, Detroit, and Nashua, New Hampshire. People in the One Fair Wage movement rallying for having restaurant workers paid a minimum wage and then tips on top of that. Are your members anticipating the need, given the labor shortage and given the, you know, the various economic exigencies that have been caused by the pandemic? Are your members expecting that, you know, their costs or simply their labor costs are going to go up, you know, in not just over the summer months, but long term? What are they telling you about that?
Well, a couple of years ago here in Maryland, we passed the path, if you will, to get to a $15 an hour minimum wage. So, you know, we understand that this is a national conversation right now, but for those of us here in Maryland, we have been planning for that for a few years now, and that's not necessarily an argument that we're dealing with right now, so to speak. Restaurants continue to pay well. Just think that restaurateurs are not a industry of opportunity is just not true. More and more people, more and more young people start out in our industry and work their way up to owning their own restaurant at the height of all of this. And many people have dreams and aspirations of that. So we continue to be an industry of choice and opportunity, but you know, there are those that continue to suggest that restaurant workers are being treated unfairly. And the reality is that back when minimum wage, the debate in Maryland happened, I believe it was in 2018, we had servers and bartenders and other tipped employees that overwhelmed the state house to testify to keep the tip wage the way that it is, because they understand that earning tips is a way to make significantly more money than minimum wage. And many people do that. So this is something that servers, bartenders, and other employees came out and said, we like the system the way it is. Restaurant employers, we certainly support them in that because we do find that the average server in here in the state of Maryland makes more than $25 an hour. So overall, restaurants continue to do their part in being the pillars of their community and the backbones. And I think that many people, up to 200,000 here in the state of Maryland, work in restaurants, and they do so for a reason because it provides a good pathway.
What about vaccine certification, these so-called vaccine passports? Do you have your members requiring their workforce to be vaccinated, or in some cases even requiring their customers to be vaccinated? What are they telling you about that?
We have not heard, or I have not heard from any member or any restaurant specifically that has enacted such a policy. In fact, I haven't even been asked a question as to what it would look like if they chose to do so. So I think that at this point in time, we still have restaurants that are requiring their employees and their customers to wear masks. And then we also have restaurants that are not requiring their employees and their customers to do so. So I think the business owner is just moving forward with their comfort level, trying to balance the safety of their employees and their customers, along with the the coming out of this pandemic. But I have not heard anything of these vaccine passports here in Maryland.
Marshall Weston is the president and CEO of the Restaurant Association of Maryland. Marshall, thank you so much. Have a good Memorial Day weekend and a great summer.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, Emily Lerman will join me. She is helping restaurant workers become restaurant owners. We'll talk about it on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, Anna Malaika Tubbs will discuss her new book, The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. Plus, the acclaimed children's author, Carol Boston Weatherford, will talk about her new book called Unspeakable, The Tulsa Race Massacre. So that's on the way for the Memorial Day edition of Midday Monday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the status of restaurants in Maryland as the post-pandemic summer season gets underway. My next guest is Emily Lerman. She's a co-founder of the Mira Kitchen Collective and a project officer with the Baltimore Roundtable for Economic Democracy, or BRED, an organization that helps co-op businesses get funding and get organized around a worker-owned model. A reminder that our show today was recorded earlier this week, so we aren't able to take any calls or online comments. Emily Lerman joins us on Zoom. Hey, Emily, how you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. So let's talk a little bit about BRED, the Baltimore Roundtable for Economic Democracy. You have your hands in all sorts of different things, and we'll talk about a few of them, I hope, in the next few minutes. But there's a restaurant called Joe Squared, which looked like it was on its way to being closed, and then all of a sudden it was revived because the workers are now the owners. Talk about that particular situation with that restaurant here in Baltimore in the Station North neighborhood and this movement to have restaurant workers become owners of the places that they're working.
Yeah, so Mira Kitchen Collective formed a couple of years ago, and we always knew that we wanted to be run and operated with the focus and centering on the workers, everyone who's doing the work. So we reached out to BRED, the Baltimore Roundtable for Economic Democracy, and here I am a couple of years later now working for BRED. You know, we reached out to them because we knew we wanted to do this thing, but we didn't know exactly how it looked. And yeah, similarly with Joe Squared, they came to the conclusion kind of during the pandemic, and I think watching what was going on around the country, that there is so much power and resilience in workers owning their businesses and owning what they do, instead of exploiting work for a few people at the top. When the workers own what they do, the the outcome is much more positive. So we're working with them on setting up what that transition to worker ownership looks like. We've been doing a worker owner readiness program. You know, a lot of people, we saw with the pandemic how unsustainable the food and restaurants were when things were shutting down so quickly. And everyone said, like, we're not going to go back to normal. I do think a lot of people are now kind of going back to normal, but there are a few businesses like Joe Squared who really, I think, are taking that more seriously and changing the way that it looks.
And do you have the sense that this is a trend that's going to continue? You know, that it won't just be in 5 years, it won't just be Mira Kitchen Collective and Joe Squared, but there'll be, you know, 5-10 other restaurants that are adopting this model. Are you getting a vibe that this is a trend that's here to stay?
I hope so. And, you know, Lawrence Lanahan in Bloomberg Business Week recently said Baltimore was one of the best places to start a co-op. So we're proud of that. And, you know, we're joined by Red Emma's and Taharka Brothers and Thread Coffee, Baltimore Bike Works, Oberon. We have a great co-op atmosphere here in Baltimore. But I hope so. I mean, it's hard. A lot of people that I talk to who are in the restaurant industry here, you mentioned worker co-op, and they get totally scared and they think it means like a lack of control and everyone's going to be deciding everything. But there's lots of different ways and lots of different structures of governance so that you can set up co-ops in different ways. So you can be, you know, completely horizontal where everyone has a say in everything, or you can have different sorts of structures where there's committees and decision-making bodies so that you're not held up over something, you know, minor. But I hope it's a trend, but I also think that, you know, democracy takes time. Things are slower. The point of a co-op is that everyone has a say and a share in what they're doing. But part of that means that everyone understands what's going on. It means that people who typically might be doing, you know, one job in the kitchen also have an understanding of what the business finances look like. And they are understanding the implications of different costs of goods sold and things that they might not typically do in a standard kind of restaurant environment. So again, that sort of takes time, but that education piece is huge and really important to worker co-ops. And it means that you have kind of more eyes and more brains behind certain decisions. So I think it will take time. Like I said, I think it's faster to kind of go this old way where you have a few people just deciding and making things go. But what's come out through this whole pandemic and is that there is a lot of toxicity in this industry. And I hope that we can change that. And I hope people can kind of be open to it and be open to the different models. Like I said, having so many successful co-ops here in Baltimore and so many who weathered the pandemic, I think none of the co-ops that that Bread has lent to during the time that Bread has existed closed down during the pandemic. They all kind of persisted and pushed through. So that's saying a lot to the power of worker co-ops.
Yeah, sure is, because we just heard from Marshall Weston that, you know, some 20% of restaurants throughout the state closed for good. So, you know, that's a good track record to be sure. Emily Lerman is my guest. She's a co-founder of the Mira Kitchen Collective and a project officer with the Baltimore Roundtable for Economic Democracy, among other activities in which she is involved. It's midday on this Memorial Day weekend. As it kicks off, we're talking about restaurants as the summer season gets going. A reminder, our conversations were pre-recorded, so we're not taking any calls or comments. So, Emily, explain how the money works. How is it that, you know, and is the division of the profit for the workers ever a barrier, ever a hang-up? Obviously, if you go to work for a restaurant and an owner, a chef hires you, you're paid a certain amount of money. Maybe you are part of the tip pool, and that's that. What's the model like for compensation for the employees in a co-op environment? Or are there different models, the way there are different governance models?
So that's a good question. And the nice thing about co-ops, which also can kind of make people uncomfortable, is that you design a governance structure and you design what you're going to do with the finances and the surplus in a way that benefits, as can be expected, the majority of the workers. So it's something that you kind of decide in your operating agreement that you say, all right, with the profits at the end of every year, we're going to put 80% back in the business and 20% of the surplus is going to go to the workers. You can do that however you want. You know, you could say we're going to take 60% or 50%. It doesn't really matter. Again, it's really up to the workers to decide. And you put this in, like I said, you put this in sort of some sort of operating or governance documents. And these things can change, you know, at during a pandemic, you could say, you know, with whatever money we have is going to all go to the workers. It really depends. And I think that's, like I said, the beauty of co-ops is that you're really trying to do what maximizes the benefit for the workers. And you can structure it in a way that does that.
And your organization, Bread, actually gets involved in the financing of these co-ops, right? I mean, you find and identify capital for some of these groups to get going or to expand what they have originally. I mean, how does what about access to capital, access to the money that some of these co-ops need to either sustain themselves in the short or long term or get started from scratch the way you did with Mira Kitchen Collective?
Yeah, you know, the financial system doesn't always lend itself to one saying that we have multiple workers and you know, people who might not have a credit history. So, and they might, you know, ask for collateral. So what Bread does is they lend, you know, it's patient capital. We form relationships with different businesses that we're going to work with that want to, or already have a sort of democratic business. And the loans are not collateralized. There's no credit checks. It's really based on the relationships that we have with the different co-ops. And that sort of means that we'll be like the first to know if there's good news and first to know if there's bad news. And we make our repayments based on profit. So once a business becomes profitable, then the kind of repayments start. But this is a process that we do together with the people that we're lending to. So we say, all right, we're going to work on your financial model together. Here's when you're going to break even. When you break even, that this is what the loan repayments are going to look like. And it's all kind of this sort of collaborative, and everyone kind of knows what's going on. It's non-extractive. It's not predatory. We're not trying to, you know, make money off of people not being able to pay their loans back. So it's really about forming deep relationships with the people that we're lending to. And it's often people that wouldn't be able to necessarily go to a bank and get money.
How's Mira Kitchen Collective doing? You've been on the show before and we've talked about it. When you started, one of the impetus was, you know, a number of immigrant women who were new to Baltimore. It was a way of them getting together and talking and sharing their love of food and of cooking, but it's certainly evolved considerably since its beginnings. Tell us where things stand, what your plans are, you know, near and long term.
Yeah, we're currently based in Station North, Charles and Landville. We have takeout that we do 2 days a week on Mondays and Fridays. And, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, we really pivoted because we said, you know, we lost all of our catering jobs. You know, our business model was very much based on people gathering together for different events and whatnot. And we shifted and we set up a GoFundMe and we started making free meals as a way of keeping people working, especially those who wouldn't be able to get benefits. And here we are, I don't even know, 14, 15 months later, and we're still able to do it. We got funding from World Central Kitchen. We got funding from grants and other donors. And we're still doing that as a way of keeping people working and keeping people fed while we're also building back Mira at the same time. And that really, you know, that pivot again was really in response to the needs of the members of Mira. And like I said, other workers in the industry who wouldn't necessarily be able to find benefits or jobs elsewhere. So we're going to keep building Mira. We hope, you know, to be catering again and to add more and more days that people can come and enjoy our food for takeout. And we're still kind of building this cooperative governance model and making sure that, you know, the current members of Mira and any new members of Mira really kind of understand what this looks like, because it is really uncommon. As much as, you know, I think it's great, it is uncommon in the industry in many work environments. And when you tell people, like, well, you have a say and you're going to be an owner, it takes time to kind of do the education around that, where it's all of a sudden it's not just like show up, clock in, do what I tell you and clock out. It's like, no, we're all going to weigh in on how this looks and what we think about these certain things.
And, you know, when it comes to making meals for the community at the beginning of the pandemic, when so many people in all industries, not just restaurants, were out of work, all of a sudden lines at, you know, food pantries were considerably larger than they had ever been, including a number of people who were very newly poor. They had never experienced food insecurity or housing insecurity. And those who were poor to begin with had an even harder time with not just the public health issues, but also, you know, just the economic issues of staying afloat. So your solution is really ingenious because it helps not only those folks who need food, but it helps those folks who need the job of making the food. I mean, that really is quite something. But give us a sense of the scope of that. How many meals are you making? How many people are you feeding? And how many people are you employing in that endeavor?
I think to date we've done probably close to 125,000. We make around 300 meals a day. A lot of them are going to Southwest Baltimore, but throughout the pandemic, I'd say, you know, we've probably given meals to over like 30 different like community organizations or even people, you know, some people call and they get 200 meals and some people call and they are so grateful. They're like, do you think, you know, that we could get five? I'm working with some youth for this after school program. And we say, yeah, sure, five. It's no problem. So, you know, we've been really fortunate that everyone who's kind of asked us has said we've been able to say yes. And that we continue to get, you know, little donations here and there, which really fuel, you know, have fueled all the work that we've been doing. We have, you know, at the peak, I think we had 10 people. We have like a very consistent group of five people who are working in the morning. And then we have another three with the Mira team who are kind of doing straddling and doing both. So around, you know, 8 to 10 people.
Yeah, that's great. And room to grow, right? I mean, room to expand as things with the pandemic loosen up. And, you know, as you say, you're going to have more people coming to your site, maybe more days and stuff. So this could easily head north, couldn't it?
Yeah. And I really hope that we can show that if you really focus on the needs of people who are doing the work, that you can thrive and be sustainable. I think, like I said, the restaurant model is built on very low margins and often very low wages. But we try to just build into our model. If we start everyone at $16 an hour, then that's just how it's going to look. And we're going to have to make that work. And hopefully consumers will get more comfortable paying a bit more for food. Because if you're eating something that's really cheap, if you're expecting to get something really cheap, you know that people are kind of being exploited, you know, from the start to the finish of the food industry or really any industry. So I hope that we can, you know, show people that this is a sustainable model. We just have to think a bit differently, but everyone will kind of benefit.
Well, I, for one, am not only a fan of the idea behind the employee cooperative model that Mira Kitchen represents, but I'm also a huge fan of the food at Mira Kitchen. So for what it's worth, I give it 5 stars. Emily Lerman, she is a co-founder of the Mira Kitchen Collective, a project officer with the Baltimore Roundtable for Economic Democracy, and with her friend Irina Stein of Alma Cucina Latina, she is employing restaurant workers and preparing free meals for folks in our community. Thanks so much, Emily. Have a great summer. I appreciate it, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, Christina Tasek joins me. She covers restaurants and dining for the Baltimore Sun. She'll be with us right after this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the Maryland restaurant industry. With Memorial Day weekend beginning today, restaurants are on the hunt for employees and customers. Christina Tasek covers dining and the food scene for the Baltimore Sun. We spoke on Tuesday. She joined me on Zoom. Hey, Christina, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. I'm doing great. Thanks.
Well, welcome to the show. When we talked to Marshall Weston at the beginning of the show today, he talked about the fact that fewer restaurants actually ended up closing during the pandemic than at one time people thought might have to close. What do you think accounts for that? As you talk to restaurateurs and chefs and folks in this business, why do you think so many restaurants were able to, you know, apparently survive these past very difficult 15 months?
I mean, you know, across the board, whether you're talking about a fine dining restaurant or a carryout operation or a catering company, it seems like what's really made a big difference is PPP funding, CARES Act funding, grant funding. I think there was an enormous amount of money that came from federal and local sources that just really helped people hang on in a way that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to.
And, you know, a number of restaurants close every year anyway. I mean, the restaurant business is a tough, tough industry. You did a piece about a guy named Kevin Alexander who wrote a book called Burn the Ice, The American Culinary Revolution and Its End. So he was pretty not sanguine about the future of restaurants. It seems like the folks in the restaurant business really have been creative, imaginative, and pretty forward-thinking when it comes to, you know, devising solutions to roll with all the punches that they got.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, as Emily talked about too, you know, I mean, there have been a lot of problems within the restaurant industry that have gone on for a while. And this man that I had interviewed him kind of at the beginning of the pandemic when we were feeling very gloom and doom about the future of restaurants. I think one historian that I spoke to thought that it could be the worst time for restaurants since Prohibition, that, you know, Prohibition being a time that basically fine dining in America ended because restaurants couldn't sell alcohol. You know, that's almost like a perfect example of like the creativity of restaurants that helped them in addition to funding. I think there was a lot of help. You know, we saw so quickly that restaurants could suddenly sell carryout alcohol and they could have carryout cocktails. And a lot of places just jumped in, you know, feet first on coming up with creative carryout menus, creative cocktail carryout menus, and that sort of thing. But kind of going back to my initial point is that, yes, the restaurant industry is really tough. And I think that book is really interesting because it talks about this kind of heyday of foodie culture, you know, with the rise of the Food Network and the rise of, you know, Top Chef and everyone wanting to have a farm to table restaurant in their neighborhood. There was, he had argued, an oversaturation of the market. You know, there'd been an oversaturation of restaurants that already have extremely thin margins between the cost of food and the cost of rent and the cost of labor. So it had always been a really tough business. So I think, you know, the precariousness of individual restaurants, I think, kind of added to the feeling of like, oh my gosh, a disastrous event like a pandemic, could this completely level this very precarious industry? And what we saw is that for various reasons, that was not the case. A combination of the creativity of individual owners and, like I said, the PPP funding and the different sources of grant funding that made a really big impact for different businesses.
Christina Tassett covers dining and the food scene for the Baltimore Sun. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We recorded our conversation a couple of days ago, so we aren't able to take online comments and calls today. So, Christina, there are people, we talk with Marshall about the difficulty that a lot of restaurant owners are having attracting a workforce, getting the workforce they used to have to come back. You did a piece about a guy who had been a head chef, and he just decided to do a complete career change. Tell us a little bit about his story, and I wonder if you think that that story is being duplicated. I guess the pandemic, you know, was a sort of moment of reckoning for people in this very tough business.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that was Chef Kai Lindeman of Nuna's, who had previously worked at the Dabney, a Michelin star winning restaurant in DC, which, you know, to a food critic, you know, someone who writes about restaurants like me is like, ooh, the, you know, very fancy. So I was really surprised when I found out that he decided almost immediately after the pandemic that he no longer wanted to be a chef and he was going to go back to school and become an accountant. I think that, you know, the restaurant industry is it's a tough industry to do business in, and it's a tough industry to work in, often with very low pay and with very long hours. And I think that for so many people, having this time, being forced to take a step back, if people had been considering leaving the industry already, this was definitely the time for them to act on that, especially with having enhanced unemployment, you know, a little bit more of a cushion. And then there were other factors too. I mean, obviously for so many people, their jobs weren't available to them. Their restaurants had shut down. They didn't know when they were going to come back. You know, if they were considering going back to work, they didn't know if they would be safe. And for people, particularly people who live with, you know, maybe they lived with elderly family, you know, I think there was a lot of concern about coming back to restaurants in general. You know, I haven't seen recent statistics about it, but I think it's undoubtedly this is going to be a big turning point for a lot of people.
Yeah. And the labor shortage in the restaurant industry, I mean, you've written about this. There was a labor shortage prior to the pandemic, wasn't there? I mean, this is not a problem that began on day one of COVID-19.
Right. There had been a labor shortage prior to the pandemic. And that's something that Kevin Alexander had written a bit about for various reasons, you know, partly being that the low pay and the long hours and some people just not wanting to do it. And part of it having to do with just the sheer number of restaurants that they were competing for a limited talent pool of chefs. There's also, we've seen declines in immigration. There's a lot of immigrants who work in restaurants traditionally. So there was a decline in people moving to the United States. So a lot of people had talked about a labor shortage and even a labor crisis before the pandemic had even begun.
And you've written, when it comes to the public health dimension of this, that line cooks in particular were hard hit in the early months of the COVID pandemic. That was a particular job in the restaurant business that really had a tough time. Why do you think that was? Why more line cooks having trouble with exposure to COVID than, you know, waiters and waitresses, et cetera?
Right. That came out. There was a study out of California that showed that cooks had the highest rate of dying from COVID of any profession. And some of the factors that this study looked at were, you know, just among the risks of almost any essential worker was naturally at greater risk by virtue of being out, you know, being out and dealing with the public. You can assume that a lot of people who work in restaurants are working in close proximity with other people. And also a lot of people who work in restaurants might share a house with many generations of people, not necessarily living alone. So it was something that that happened, at least in this study, you know, across the board. It was the rate was highest for Latin Americans, and then second highest, I believe, for Black Americans. But, you know, also white Americans who worked in kitchens also had a much higher rate of dying from COVID.
Yeah, and of course, there were problems in the processing plants as well. Christina Tassick covers dining and the food scene for the Baltimore Sun. It's midday. We're talking restaurants on this first day of the Memorial Day weekend as the summer season kicks off for enjoyment and recreation and a bit of travel. And restaurateurs certainly hope a bit of dining out. So, Christina, you wrote a wonderful story about one of my favorite restaurants. It's been a favorite ever since it opened years ago, the Helmand Afghanistan restaurant in Midtown in Mount Vernon. This is a guy who's Kayum Karzai, who's actually the brother of the former president of Afghanistan. He's married to an American woman, and they've lived here for a number of years. You know, these are, for people who've been here for a while, a place like the Helmand really is an iconic place. There are several others. You know, you think of Tio Pepe's or the Prime Rib, which I understand is moving from its longtime location. You know, it's not just the restaurants that have been open for a year or two that are struggling. It's some that have been, you know, really fundaments of their communities for a long time. What did you learn when you talked to the folks over at the Helmand?
Right. And, you know, it was in some cases, I think these legacy restaurants, these restaurants that I think have been around for ages and ages, in some ways they were well positioned to make it through the pandemic because they had a very loyal customer base. But in other ways, they were really at a disadvantage because, for example, with the Helmand, they had not previously done much carryout at all. They really struggled with using third-party apps like Grubhub and Uber Eats, taking, you know, huge chunks of the profit on those orders.
They really had to learn that part of the business, didn't they? They had to you know, really pivot. Yeah, that can be hard for any business, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was a huge challenge for them. And they did, Kayum did tell me that they had considered closing, but fortunately, I think they were able to work with their landlord in Mount Vernon on an agreement about rent. And that's been a really kind of make or break situation for a lot of restaurants, I think, is if they don't own their property, the willingness of their landlord to negotiate has been huge. So, you know, hopefully we'll see the Helmand pull through. I know that after that story ran, I was very gratified because Kayum called me and said that their phone had been ringing off the hook with orders. So I think once people realized, oh my gosh, this beloved restaurant is at risk, they showed out in force.
Yeah. Well, I know Linnell and I throughout the pandemic have made a point to, you know, to try to patronize some of our favorite places once or twice a week just to, you know, help them out and keep them going as much as we enjoy cooking. Talk about a little bit about these third-party delivery apps, the Grubhubs and Uber Eats and that kind of thing. The city council did pass an ordinance limiting the amount of money they can charge the restaurants, and Baltimore City by no means the only one who's the only jurisdiction that's done that. But that was a real boost for these restaurants here in town, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, in addition to dollars and cents, it making a real difference in dollars and cents. So the city council passed a cap on, I think, limiting the share that third-party apps like Grubhub, Uber Eats, and others can take to I think it was 15%. And so that made a huge difference. And I think also, you know, campaigns like that and, you know, coverage of stories like that has seemed to make a difference in the public's awareness of this. So some restaurant owners that I spoke to while reporting on that had said that they were now seeing more customers becoming aware of just how much of a chunk the apps take. And so some customers were saying, you know, for example, with the Helmand, you know, saying, okay, we're going to order from you directly because we know that it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. That I think restaurant owners were hugely supportive of. I did not hear anybody complaining about that law.
I bet. Well, let's wish them all good luck as the summer begins. Let's hope that they can continue to thrive and continue to be part of, you know, our food and cultural scene here in town and throughout the state. Christina Tasek covers dining and food for the Baltimore Sun. Thanks so much, Christina. Have a great summer. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. You too.
That's it for us today. On Monday, Memorial Day, I will speak with Carol Boston Weatherford. She is the author of a new book that introduces young readers to a horrific event in American history called Unspeakable, the Tulsa Race Massacre. I'll also talk with Anna Malaika Tubbs. She's written a biography of three women called The Three Mothers, How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. That's coming up Memorial Day, Monday on Midday. Our director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Mallory Pickard-Pierre is our supervising producer. Rob Sivek's our senior producer. Jamila Kremple is WYPR's digital content director. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Reveals up next after news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great holiday weekend.